Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Romesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
Stronger podcast, fairer podcast for everyone. Strike up the band!
Let Sunak be Sunak is different from Let Sunak be Cummings.
Try it's and all start the year being a little fair to Edwin the band, will you, Danny?
They absolutely should not water this down to the point of homeopathic disappearance.
Here we are again then. It's How to Win an Election with me, Matt Chorley, joined as ever by our political masterminds, New Labour mastermind, Peter Mandelson, Polly McKenzie's Policy McKenzie, formerly Nick Clegg's brain, Director of Policy for the Lib Dems, and Tory brain box, Daniel Finkston. How are we all?
Fine. We just had a bit of a debate about whether Matt's jacket is dapper or not, which is even more amusing for people listening because they can have to imagine.
You better watch it. You can watch it back on YouTube.
Dapper. Peter was a bit more sceptical about it than Polly was.
It's quite soft. I think there's a lack of interfacing.
Is there? You mean it's not got strong shoulders?
No.
But maybe it's the problem. I've not got strong shoulders. Do you think of anyone else who's not got strong shoulders, Peter?
Come on, you've got better shoulders than Ed Miliband.
Well, let us know what you think about what we're all wearing. You can email howtowin@thetimes.co.uk if you are watching on YouTube. Now, we've had some emails. Last week, Polly, we were talking about your elections to watch. You chose Taiwan. Well, we've had an email about what you said. Says, hi, I'm Xu Yang, I speak Chinese, and I just want to say that Polly's pronunciation of
KMT Kuomintang
on the previous episode was absolutely accurate.
Phew.
Glad that one of the three chose the Taiwanese elections because it matters, and under the current circumstances, it's romantic to Happy New Year. So there we are. Well done. If you want to get in touch, how to win election at thetimes.co.uk. Now, we're going to talk about smaller parties, but particularly the Lib Dems, because Ed Davies all splashed all over the papers, which is normally what the Lib Dems would like, but possibly not for the reason that he would. So we'll talk about that in a minute. But since we last met, Rishi Sunak has said his working assumption is the election will be in the second half of the year. Ben emailed in from Portishead, the place, not the group, he says. Sunak has just talked about the general election being in the second half of the year. People are taking this at face value and saying it'll then be in the autumn. I think he could be doing this to wrongfoot Labour so they'll be caught off guard when he calls a snap election in the spring. What do you think, Peter?
I think that's a pretty astute observation because he hasn't ruled out an autumn election. Working assumption is the sort of vaguest formulation he could get away with. Obviously, the speculation about the election was sort of getting under his skin, as so much else is seemingly doing these days with the Prime Minister. But I think, you know, if he saw, for example, you know, the sort of green shoots of economic recovery and by some sort of miraculous sort of renaissance, the economy suddenly started looking up, he might make a dash for it. Or if he saw in the Labour Party some policy weakness or division or whatever, he might want to take advantage of that. I mean, I can't think in the Labour Party what policy area might come before their absolute determination to win the election, but it's possible. Of course, if he does delay it to the autumn, then he's giving the Labour Party plenty of time to iron out any policy weaknesses and friction. So in a sense, he might be doing the Labour Party a favour.
It's basically what you suggested last week, isn't it, Danny? He had to sort of hose it down without categorically ruling it out.
Yeah, I think he has pretty much. I mean, I think if we've learnt something about Rishi Sunak in the last year, it is that his political calculation is not his greatest game. So I just think maybe you might, as Prime Minister, have tried to lure the Labour Party onto the rocks. I just think he told us when he's thinking of holding the general election. And if you aren't going to hold the general election in May and you aren't going to hold it in January 2025, it's better probably to say it. So my view is we now know, roughly speaking, when the election is. There's a small chance, of course, in all things that it won't be then. But by and large, we know when it is. And so we can stop discussing that and concentrate on what actually are the issues. Yeah, yeah. By the way, if the the reason why I don't think this is the right thing to do, to wait till October, November, is because if you try to put a list together of the things that might change between now and then, you're hard put to it to discover what they are. And so therefore, I think a feeling that an election has been delayed will simply build a case, will build a momentum against the Conservatives. So I wouldn't have done this. But if I was going to do it, if I was going to hold it in the autumn, he clearly wants to do that. I sort of thought he probably would. And if he does want to do that, then it's right to say so that at least he doesn't get the, everyone thinks he's going to go in May and then he says at the last minute he's not going to.
And actually, I was struck at the weekend, Keir Starmer saying that all he's doing is he wants to clock up 2 years in Downing Street. It's putting vanity before country. That sort of mood could start. But the one thing it has done is ruled out your theory, Polly, that we're going to end up having an election in 2025.
Well, he said it's not going to happen. Yeah. There are no guarantees in politics. He's definitely in a stronger position now, because if he had allowed that speculation to continue, then going for the autumn would look weak. Now, on the off chance he does go for May, it looks strong to do so. Like Danny, I think that his best bet for the Conservative Party would be to go early, to go in the spring. I still don't think he will. Mm. And what if bad things come along in October and November and there's bad news? He still could string it out just to get that extra year onto his...
Well, I suppose that's a calculation. You could be waiting for something to turn up, but the risk is that something might turn up.
Well, I tell you what I think the risk of turning up is Donald Trump in the autumn. If, as is almost certain to be the case, he's the Republican candidate. He is going to run a mother and father of campaigns, and that's going to coincide with and overlap with Rishi Sunak's election campaign. And I think that's a sort of association he doesn't want to invite. They will be running, after all, similar campaigns. I mean, small estate, lower taxes, tough on immigration, etc. And I think that what...
Danny, you're wincing.
That's even more stretched than your jumper neck.
Why do you say that?
That they're going to be running similar campaigns. Indeed, I think, actually, I'd put it to you that the difficulty for Sunak will be exactly the opposite. It's quite considerable, this difficulty. I agree with that. But the difficulty is simply that there'll be a populist campaign to Sunak's right by the Farageists, maybe even by Nigel Farage. Yeah. It will gain a lot of energy from Donald Trump's campaign. There'll be pressure on Sunak to run Donald Trump's election campaign, but he neither has the inclination to do that, nor the capacity for it, because he's a very different
person.
But
what's the alternative, Danny? I mean, he has already decided to open the new year by being not the change candidate, but the continuity candidate. Britain's on the right track. Don't risk it with Labour.
Well, in fact, let's just remind ourselves of that, because Danny's previously talked about the three types of elections: time for a change, on the right track, or better the devil you know. So here he was being changey-changey at the party conference in October.
But the worst thing about Sir Keir is that he just says whatever he thinks will benefit him the most. Doesn't matter whether he can deliver it. Doesn't matter if it's true. It doesn't matter if he said the opposite just a few weeks or months ago. He is the walking definition of the 30-year political status quo I am here to end.
So there he was, changey-changey. And then this is him yesterday.
Now, the choice facing our country at that election is, do we stick with the plan that is starting to deliver the long-term change that our country needs, or do we go back to square one?
So this is a major switch in strategy. I hadn't realised it had been quite as stark as it is. But he is becoming the continuity candidate. And he is spearheading this campaign, Danny, I'm afraid, on two issues. One is lower taxation, which he can only advocate by embracing a smaller state, the state doing less and spending less in order to give lower taxes instead. And the other is immigration, which is still a drum that he keeps on beating, I think, in a rather futile way. But nonetheless, there's colossal pressure. Okay. In his both within his party and outside his party in the reform, to pursue these issues. Now you say, well, that's got nothing to do with Donald Trump. It just so happens that those are Donald Trump's issues.
The second of those is, but the first of them, a smaller state, is not really, lower taxation isn't really Donald Trump's theme. He is running a populist campaign, which is about the whole nature of the establishment. It is indeed the campaign that Rishi Sunak, I did think, did dally with, but could never have pulled off because he's not Donald Trump. So I think that the idea that those two will be the same
he's basically not true. Donald Trump is doing both these things. Of course he wants to offer lower taxes and a smaller state while saving everyone from oblivion. I mean, he's a sort of Johnsonian character. He's both a nationalist and somebody who wants to bail everyone out of their troubles by spewing out populist slogans the entire time. The point I'm making is that, in the media, in the public's mind, there will be these two campaigns running in parallel, and there will be a lot of pressure on Sunak, both within his party and from the Farageists in the Reform Party, to change course and strike a more populist right-wing set of notes. Trump will be doing the same in the United States. All these things are at risk of merging in the public's mind. And for a candidate like Sunak, who has to broaden his base and reach out to the centre of politics, if he's going to stand any chance, I think that is... I think it's not brand enhancing for him.
Polly, what do you make of all this?
I think Peter's also done an about turn.
Oh.
Well, because you said that he was going to run a campaign like Trump, and now you're saying that he's going to come under pressure to run a campaign like Trump. So I've slightly lost...
Well, the two things are not opposite. I mean, he will come under pressure because a lot of people in his own party don't want continuity conservatism because they don't think it's real conservatism. Real conservative campaign headed by a real conservative leader, with real conservative policies, and we all know where that
And it's, I think, it's the reason why Sunak has pivoted so much from one set of campaign messages to something completely different is because he isn't holding his party together. He is coming under pressure. He doesn't really know who he is or what he is that he wants to do.
And what point does that... Because clearly what he's done is he's tried one thing and he thought, well, that's not worked. He tried just quiet delivery, his five pledges a year ago, gave that 6 months, that didn't work. It was a wobble over the summer. He became the change candidate in the autumn. That didn't work. Then he brought back David Cameron, so he can't be the change candidate if he's attacking David Cameron. But at what point is all that sort of flip-flopping, what they accuse Keir Starmer of, does that become a problem in and of itself? It's not just that he keeps changing, it's that people can seize all over the place.
Well, it's interesting as well that the half-life of these individual slogans is reducing, right? Like 6 months, 3 months, we've got exponential reductions in the length of his campaign slogans. So there will come a point when people will notice that he has not said the same thing more than 2 days in a row. And the way that desperation harms strategy is becoming more and more apparent. They are casting around because they're frightened.
I think it was lamentable to put forward that, in my view, absurd time for a change strategy. I understood why they did it, because there's a public mood that it's time for a change, and because continuity will be so difficult to make work, but it was obviously not going to be able to land it. I think, therefore the criticism that's being levelled against them is completely merited. However, it's also important to remember that literally nobody knows that he made that speech, except for a few political aficionados, that he made a speech about change. It'll have damaged his reputation among people who are commenting like us about his political strategy, but really the crucial thing is, does he land with enough time on broadly the correct strategy? And I think he has. So I'm pleased about that. I think, as we've discussed before, the biggest problem he's got, and Polly's put it so well, that's a brilliant phrase about the impact of desperation on political strategy. The problem for the Conservative Party is none of these strategies, time for a change, better the devil you know, or continuity, Britain's on the right track, none of them quite work. But of the three of them, this is definitely the best one.
I'm not sure I agree with that. I think it's harder than you imagine to run a continuity, you know, Britain's doing well, Britain's heading in the right direction, isn't Britain looking up, so let's just continue. That fights completely with reality, the national mood, and what voters think.
You see,
I think there's a variation of change which he could have adopted, and it is the 1986 Thatcher model of the next steps forward. He's got to say, what is the point of voting for a fifth
term? But that was Britain's on the right track. They actually used that slogan.
Yeah, I know, Danny. But they also had a programme which they launched in their 1986 conference, a year ahead of the election, where she set out all the next things that a Conservative government was going to do. We haven't seen hide nor hair.
No, I agree with that. So I'm not just saying, you've got to show, when you say Britain's on the right track, you've got to show what the track is, obviously. Brett, you do. I mean,
I think people know what the track is. What they want to know is, where is this track leading to?
That's what I mean by track.
What is a re-elected fifth-term going to do to take, you know, what are the building blocks? What do they do next?
That's why they say stop in your tracks when you're not going anywhere. But I'm talking about going down a track.
Yeah.
And we're getting lost in our metaphors here. The point about Britain's on the right track, don't turn back, is that it's a strategy that says we've got a direction. Right. If you want to keep on doing these things, we know where we're going, we know what the next steps are. Right. And that's the only strategy.
That is what is absent.
No, there's no sign of that. They've now endorsed the fact that they're going to try to advance that, and that's a good thing.
But it's really hard for them to do it when the Conservative Party has had five prime ministers, five different sets of tracks that they have been on.
Of course.
Most of whom going in conflicting areas, directions. Each different prime minister has slagged off the previous prime minister. And so I think that's why we had Danny Kruger, a backbench MP, talking this week. Leaked comments saying that, unfortunately, the country is in a worse off situation than it was 13 years ago when the Conservatives took power. And as Peter says, if that is people's kind of lived experience, their reality on the ground, then saying it's starting to work, like, that's fine for Margaret Thatcher in her going into her second term, right? It wasn't her second term.
It was going into my third, the third election in 86.
86.
I thought you said 80. Anyway, whatever. I'm too young. It's hard truth.
Are you starting to become a bit ageist? Is this what's creeping in here? Look,
yes,
also,
absolutely.
We shouldn't forget what the real Conservative campaign is going to be about, and that is Labour. And he will be day in, day out trying to work out how he can get into the single, in a single sentence, right up until polling day, the words Labour, higher taxes, additional borrowing.
Yes. Yeah.
That is what the Conservative campaign is heading towards.
So an interesting question, Matt, is will he abandon the second part of the strategy, which is the bit where he says the problem with Starmer is he's all over the shop and you don't know what he stands for, in favour of he's very dangerous. So that's the other bit.
Because he can't both be very dangerous and not believe in anything.
Correct. That's a choice as well.
Up next, we're not going to do Labour. We're going to do Lib Dem. Ed Davey is all over the papers. He's facing calls to resign. It's always, you know, the big problem the small party often has is trying to get attention, but it's the sort of attention they need. And what role will they play in the next election? We'll do that next on How to Win an Election.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah, this is How to Win Election with me, Matt Chorley, joined by Peter Madison, Polly McKenzie and Daniel Finkelstein. Now, we talk a lot about Rishi Sunak and the Tories and Keir Starmer and the Labour Party. But unusually, the leader of one of the smaller parties, Ed Davey, seems to be dominating the news, but not in the way he'd like, facing questions about his time in government. Polly, he probably thought he was beyond the baggage of the coalition years. He'd be very careful to sort of try not to mention his involvement in 5 years of being in power.
I think he has talked with pride about his record as Energy Secretary, actually, and rightly so, you know, given the impact that that period had on where we've got to on renewables. You know, it's interesting to me. Ed was the Postal Services Minister. He did refuse to meet Alan Bates. He then met Alan Bates and was the first Postal Minister to do so. But much more interestingly, really, he was one of 12 Postal Ministers over the course of this extraordinary, monstrous injustice. Covering Labour, the Liberal Democrats and the Conservatives. And it feels very much like political machinations that he is being targeted as the sole Postal Services Minister being held up for opprobrium. There's one good argument in favour of that. He's the only one who happens to currently be a party leader, I guess, of the 12. But it feels very much like... it is convenient for both Labour and the Conservatives to deflect blame onto somebody else. It would be really nice if they could say this wasn't a monumental failure of the state, a monumental failure of all three political parties, but say, oh, it was those awful yellow people. It was all Ed Davey's fault. And I think that if we did decide to crystallise blame around Ed Davey, that would be a real shame because... Actually, we need to think very seriously about how something so awful could be permitted to happen by essentially an arm of the state.
Well, to be fair to Ed Davey, I spoke to him about this last week and put to him a question. It was asked, actually, I'd previously interviewed Alan Bates, who he refused to meet and then had met, the leading post office campaigner, and I put that question to Ed Davey.
I was deeply misled by post office executives. And Alan is right to raise the point. They didn't come clean. And there was definitely attempts to stop me meeting them. And I regret that we didn't do more, but we were clearly misled. I think ministers from all political parties were misled.
Peter.
And that is that this whole issue really broke out into the open in 2010, if my memory serves me right, with the imprisonment, of a pregnant Surrey sub-postmistress who was accused of stealing £74,000, and she was handed down, wrongful conviction, and handed down a term of imprisonment. And that's when all this really broke out into the open. It then took Ed Davey 2 years before he set up an inquiry to look into the failing glitches in the software of the whole Horizon system. Now, I'm not exonerating everyone else. I think it is very unfortunate to sign off a letter presented to you saying, I don't think there would be any useful purpose in talking to you about this, when this whole issue had burst into the open as it had done with this wrongful conviction in 2010. So I think, you know, you're making a reasonable point, Polly, but I think he has more to answer for than perhaps you're implying.
Basically, I think Polly's right. It would be absurd to crystallise the whole of this into Ed Davey. Actually, by the way, the Computer Weekly story came in 2009. You know, Tracy Felstead went to jail in 2002. Everybody is implicated, and it would be absurd to crystallise it merely in Ed Davey. But it would also be absurd not to crystallise it in anybody, right? So my view is it's appropriate that everybody responds to what was is one of the great scandals of the post-war era, with some reflection. You know, I'm thinking about it too, as to our own reactions to it, the speed of them, the things that we thought worked that didn't work, you know, what the private finance initiative and its implications for computing, the system, the benefit system, and how it was introduced into the swipe cards, the whole way that we interact with the post office. Everybody's got to think about all of these things. You're right, Polly. It just happens that Ed Davey is one of the most prominent people from who was involved with it, who's still left, and therefore I think it's a chance. You know, as it happens, I generally speaking think the position of being leader of the Liberal Democrats isn't actually that valuable a one, right? So because I don't think there's anything that the Liberal Democrats stand for that you couldn't have as an opinion and be in the shadow cabinet holding. And so therefore, the Liberal Democrats are going to help Labour get elected, which is totally fine because they're a centre-left party, and then stay outside the government that they helped to form for reasons that I cannot understand. And when we had a discussion over Christmas as to what it was the Liberal Democrats, apart from electoral reform, to help themselves because of their resistance as a party, would actually want, it turned out there wasn't anything that they want that Labour wouldn't be perfectly willing to do anyway. So I think he could do something much more useful than being leader of the Liberal Democrats, which is to say, in this political system, somebody has to take responsibility, and I'm the sort of person who comprehends that. Paula Vernells isn't willing to take responsibility. The Tories gave her an honour. They're not willing to take responsibility. Labour had a role before the 2010 general election in this. Nobody, you know, the media, you could accuse everyone and say, but me... Because I'm a Liberal Democrat, because that's what Liberal Democrats do, that's why we're different, I am going to resign. I think there would be a power to that he's not going to get from any of the other things that he does, most of which don't change anything.
Yeah. Peter, we should point out, you were business secretary immediately before. Was this something that came across your desk? Were you aware of, you know, Danny was listening, it obviously went back a long time. Do you feel you were misled by the post office?
I wasn't dealing with it on a day-to-day basis, no. My department was, other ministers were. But I do remember what was the absolutely dominant issue at the time to do with post offices, and that was the programme of closures, which a previous Secretary of State had agreed with the Treasury, and we were facing enormous political pressure. I mean, my department was having to field ministers to weekly adjournment debates in the House of Commons as MPs, you know, took up the cudgels of their local post office, and it was a huge issue. I mean, it just absorbed vast amounts of time and energy, and I'm afraid to say it was a massive distractor from this really big and an appalling set of circumstances that befell these sub-post office.
Well, I suppose it actually points to the fact that people felt very strongly about their post office. The post office is, you know, a great institution that people want to stand and defend,
yeah,
which was precisely the brand, if you like, that the post office were leaning on. People felt they couldn't question what was going on at this great institution.
Well, the other issue, of course, was that by then the post office had become a sort of an arm's length, sort of separate body that was operationally independent of the government. And there were just endlessly drafted letters put up to ministers to use to reply to MPs saying, you know, this is a matter for the post office. Yeah. Now, as I say, I mean, this started sort of bubbling up in the years before we left office. But the major breakthrough was that appalling imprisonment that occurred in 2010.
Prosecutions continued until 2015, I think. The idea that there was a sort of watershed moment when...
Publicly, there was.
Yeah.
Yes, there was.
Well, I suppose the questions have been asked, but there's still no evidence, you know, the prosecution. But I suppose this goes also to the problem. People said, well, Ed Davey asked questions. He says, I wish I asked more. I mean, it now appears, if you haven't watched the documentary and read a lot of it, that what even was being said in the courts by the post office wasn't true. So it's not a huge surprise that perhaps lying to ministers. But this is the problem of being a minister, isn't it? How many times can you say to an official or a public body, is this right, before you just have to, you know, you've got other things to deal with?
Yeah, but this is what you have civil servants for. Mm. I mean, they are engaged day to day in managing the relationship between the government and the post office. I'm not trying to sort of point the finger at particular civil servants, obviously, but they should have been much more focused and cognizant of what was going on. And their job is to, in a sense, to both to protect ministers and serve the wider public interest, and in this instance, that failed.
We correctly argued that Boris Johnson was not in command of Number 10 Downing Street, the people that he'd employed, and was lied to by officials about what sort of parties were taking place in Number 10 Downing Street, and then did not assiduously in any way...
As follow, if he didn't know.
..follow up. Well, you're asking that question. So you're asking that exact question. And my conclusion was that it was a resigning matter for exactly the sort of questions that you raise your eyebrows about. But you cannot say that and then turn around to somebody who I think does have a greater reputation for probity and conscientiousness, like Ed Davey, and say that rule doesn't apply to him. Because I can assure you that if this post office scandal had all been Boris Johnson's fault, we would never have heard the end of it, right? The week of the rest is politics would be holding special podcasts only to concentrate on that. Twitter would have been full of it, right? But it's because it was spread among all the political parties and every political argument and didn't seem to prove anybody right that nobody took it up, really.
So you're asking him to turn the clock back 10 years and retrospectively resign?
I'm asking him to take responsibility for it as a political act. I'm actually more suggesting it to him, actually, rather than, you know, because what am I to ask him to do it?
So let's zoom out a little bit then, because clearly, you know, the Lib Dems had a long time under the radar, nobody's thinking about them, you know, they're bubbling along 10, 12 points in the polls. What impact will this have? You know, because we've seen it before, you know, Tim Fowen spent the 2017 election campaign almost entirely talking about his views on gay sex. That wasn't a big election issue, but, that, you know, he got embroiled in that. If the election campaign, as and when it comes, is embroiled with questions about Ed Davey's probity, or people have already decided about that, will it become an election problem, I suppose, is the question.
Well, I think it affects all of the parties at two levels. The one is the obvious PR issues around, you know, what does the public think about Ed Davey, or what do they think about Keir Starmer's supposed involvement, which Boris Johnson kept bringing up with Jimmy Savile, for example. You know, being able to say, and we've actually seen a whole series of stories briefed into the papers about Keir Starmer, you know, was the barrister who defended this bad guy or that bad guy without sort of acknowledging that that's like literally how barristers work. They have this cab rank rule and they have to take the next client. So, and that is being done partly to muddy the water and suggest that these guys are not to be trusted, shouldn't be elected. But the other thing it does is it actually eats up operational capacity for the political parties. That particularly affects the smallest party, the Liberal Democrats, because they've just got fewer people. In the 2010 general election, there was this wall of allegations thrown at Nick Clegg after he did so well during that the leaders' debate, alleging all sorts of financial improprieties in his office which weren't true, alleging that he was a Nazi sympathiser, you know, like just all of this stuff, and part that was laughable to lots of people at the public level, but what it did to us as the several dozen people working on the campaign is it just kept everybody busy for 16 hours a day.
Somebody who could be doing something else has to go and find the thing that he wrote to see this, that's what he said. And
I'll tell you what the public think about Ed Davey, which is they don't. They have never heard of him. And that's to the extent to which people have not heard of Ed Davey is really important for everybody who listens to this podcast to understand, because everybody who listens to this podcast almost is a selecting group that who knows who he is.
But the point is, Danny, when he's been introduced to them for the first time through this lens.
So that's what I agree with you completely. So now, for the first time, he will appear through to the consciousness, by the way, only of even now a very limited number of people. But during the election, when there's a little bit more broadcasting time equality, I think that he will then face this quite a lot. I think the impact it will probably have on bottom line voting will not be that great. If you wanted to vote Liberal Democrat in a seat, mainly it'll be as an alternative to Labour to get rid of the Tories. That'll still be a stronger impulse. And your view about Ed Davey's conduct as post office minister probably won't affect it that greatly. So I think this is an opportunity for Ed Davey to do something more consequential and useful than being leader of the Liberal Democrats. But I recognise that is a niche view, and every time I express it, people laugh. I'm deadly serious.
But also, at some point, we must come back to this question, because a political party can have profound impact in the system as we saw with UKIP, without winning an election. And actually, the fact of there being three parties has an impact that I think Danny is sort of completely disregarding.
Although,
when
Ed was on last week, because he actually came on to talk about his campaign, and he was talking about tax thresholds and people being advantaged of the tax. And he said when he was in government, the tax thresholds went up. I said, oh, very good. So, are you saying the tax thresholds should go up? Well, I'm not going to set out my tax plans now. okay, so would you, you were in government with the Conservatives last time. Would you do that again? No, I wouldn't do that. Would you go into government with the Labour Party? I'm not here to answer hypotheticals. I'm going to. So he's not committing to a plan.
Sounds a great interview.
And even if he didn't have a plan, even if he did have a plan, he's not going to demand that the Labour Party do it as the price of going into government.
He said that he wouldn't go in with the Conservatives, but he also said he wouldn't answer hypotheticals.
Yes.
But isn't whether he'd go in with the Conservatives or hypothetical.
Yeah.
Okay. Well spotted, Danny.
Thank you. All right. Look, was it that blindingly obvious? I'm really sorry. That was very obtuse.
That's a fundamental. The other thing that strikes me, Peter, is that we always hear people saying, somebody says or does something daft, this is going to be played again and again during the election campaign. And we never hear of these things again. We should be realistic with that. It is January, an election in October, November. What Ed Davey did or didn't do in January about something he didn't do in 2010 is probably going to be slightly less pertinent.
Of course, but the fact remains that for the overwhelming bulk of the British people, the first time they will have known or ever heard of Ed Davey is through this story and through this lens. And so it will sort of lodge in people's minds. Will it make a great sort of difference to how they vote for or against the Liberal Democrats? No, whenever the election comes. People will be voting Liberal Democrat in order to get the Tories out. Let's be honest. I mean, the much bigger group in the electorate than those who are sort of minded to vote Liberal Democrat are people who don't vote, don't know, don't care, and probably going to abstain. So that's how much the Liberal Democrats matter. But here's the fact, is that the Rishi Sunak and the Conservatives are going to sort of face a sort of double pincer action. To the right, there are going to be people peeling off and voting for Farage and the Reform Party because that's what they feel like doing. They want to punish the Conservatives, but they don't want to vote for the Labour Party. They want to vote for a sort of nationalist, populist alternative. And to the left, he's going to be faced with people peeling off to vote for the Liberal Democrats when they think the Liberal Democrats have a better chance in a particular constituency of unseating the Conservatives. This is the electoral reality. It doesn't actually matter what the Liberal Democrats say or do. There is still going to be this pincer action on the left with people voting Liberal Democrat because they want to punish the Tories.
And actually, the fact that people didn't know who he was part of the strategy. They wanted something nice and quiet, and then you could vote for the Lib Dems wherever you thought. I've actually just looked up on YouGov's list of the most famous other UK public figures. 64% know who Ed Davey is. He's sandwiched between Neil Hamilton and Chris Patten. So make of that what you will.
What was the question?
But is that prompted?
I don't know. I'm just reading out. Fame is defined by the percentage of people who have heard of the public figure.
Oh, that's different.
When asked, have you heard of Ed Davey?
Yeah, they may also be thinking about Ed Vasey. This is always an occupational hazard. Enough questions from me. It's time for some questions that you've emailed in. In fact, this was the word of the year last year. It was whiz, which I don't need to tell you, Peter, is short for
risible.
Charisma. Edwina emailed in and said, "Hi, Matt. I've just listened to the latest podcast and really enjoyed it. I have a few questions to ask the panel. Who do the panel think are the most charismatic people within the main political parties at the moment? And who do they think were the most charismatic leaders of the main political parties in the past?" And I suppose the follow-on question is, does charisma matter? Peter, who do you think's got it?
In Labour?
Well, any parties,
I think that alongside Keir Starmer, the two strong women he has on each side of him, Rachel Reeves and Angela Rayner, have a sort of combined charisma package. I mean, they appeal to different groups of voters, but together I think they're quite a powerful combination. I suppose in the rest of the shadow cabinet, amongst the men, Wes Streeting and Peter Kyle are the two most frequently
Ed Miliband,
talked about.
Ed Miliband, surely, Peter. Be fair to him.
To be fair to Ed. Can we move on, please?
I mean, Daddy's a god.
I'm not sure that I think charisma is a good thing, and I'm pleased that not very many people in current British politics have got it. I think Boris Johnson had charisma. I didn't think that was a particularly good thing. I think John McDonnell has a certain kind of charisma. I thought it was extremely dangerous. I think it would be absolutely preposterous preposterous to suggest that Keir Starmer has charisma, but it just is. I know. I realised that Peter kind of felt he had to include it in this artful way at the beginning of his sentence, not quite saying he had charisma.
Artful.
But it was it was artfully done. But truthfully, one of Keir Starmer's, I think he recognises himself, actually. I think one of Keir Starmer's great advantages is that he is not very charismatic. He's promising people as he's, I thought, quite a clever political strategy with kind of dullness.
Polly, anyway. Anyone?
Yeah, charisma is not the same thing as being sort of presidential. And Keir Starmer, I think, has the potential to be presidential.
Yes, possible.
But the charisma of could you present Have I Got News For You is something actually better left to national treasures like Boris Johnson, Olivia Colman,
or even
Michael Portillo.
Even in his day, Charles Kennedy.
There we are, exactly. Very good. Right, that was How to Win an Election with me, Matt Chorley, alongside Peter Manson, Polly McKenzie, and Daniel Finkelstein.